Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Eric Duplais, the director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle, has broadened his portfolio beyond the Northwest and is now sharing the lessons learned in the Northwest about how to stop fossil fuel projects. He's working with environmentalists working to stop fracking along the Ohio River in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Today, Eric returns to Locus Focus to talk about what he is learning about the severe ecological and social destruction ravaging Appalachian communities. But first, we'll talk about the impending impeachment threatening the Trump administration and all his sycophants. And we'll also talk about two major climate actions in Washington State that took place last week during the climate strike. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's always good to be here.
Well, it's always great to talk to you and kind of check in on what's happening in the world. And this has been a particularly interesting week. So we thought before we start talking about the usual fossil fuel subjects that did you open your time capsule and see how things jibe between what your friends were suggesting 2.5 years ago and what's actually transpired in the last week?
I did. I was just skimming through it this morning in preparation for this show. And for folks who maybe don't know, I should let them know that when Trump was elected, and everyone I knew was sort of freaking out and wondering what was going to happen, I had people send me their predictions in kind of time capsule form, and I wrote them down. I sort of archived them in a spreadsheet here, and it's fun to kind of check back. Fun is in air quotes to check back and see how accurate or inaccurate various predictions were. You know, I had people do it at certain stages. So the nearest stage we have to today was actually for 3 years from inauguration, so January 20th of 2020. So that's not so far from now. So I'll use that one as our standard, as our benchmark for today, I think.
So what was predicted for January 2020?
Well, let's see. Lots of different things here. I'm gonna sort of anonymize the people because I don't know if I have permission to use people's name on the air, but I could perhaps use yours, Barbara.
You can use mine, sure. Okay, I'm here, so you might as well use mine.
Okay, good. So let's. You gave us a bunch of predictions. One of which was Democrats, having taken back the House and the Senate, immediately moved to impeach Trump in January 2019. In the meantime, a growing movement is calling to void the 2016 election and have new elections, creating a constitutional crisis. Was not quite right, but
I was off by 6 months or 8 months, and also off about the House, the Senate. But
exactly.
I wonder about that because I was just reading today and yesterday about all the people in the Trump administration that could be ensnared in this scandal, including Mike Pence. So it's starting to look like we might have a constitutional crisis after all.
Yeah, well, and I think Attorney General Barr is in potentially serious trouble as well as Giuliani. I mean, so I think we could have a situation where the legal side is in big trouble as well. So yeah, I agree. There are all kinds of strange, and actually a lot of people who answered this predicted, you know, either a constitutional crisis or some very serious outcome like that. Here's one from a fundraiser friend of mine, and she wrote, when confronted with ample irrefutable evidence that Trump has benefited financially from deals made supposedly on behalf of the U.S., Republican leaders continue their longtime strategy of refusing to acknowledge reality.
That sounds pretty accurate.
Yeah. Let me see what else I can find here. Here's one from a researcher who writes about democracy issues, and she wrote, "This is by January 2020, and so she could still turn out to be right. Trump is impeached. Pence is president. Trump starts a reality TV show about being president, called the Trump Wing or King of the World, or so you think you can rule the free world." But his electoral base is cheering on a new change presidential candidate, even more dangerous than Trump.
Any suggestion who that is, or that's anonymous?
I'm going to anonymize that one because I don't know how.
Who the presidential candidate would be, who is even worse than Trump.
She didn't make a prediction about who that would be, but maybe you'd be willing to step into that.
There's so many of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, I was kind of curious about looking at what's happening, in Washington right now and in Ukraine and every place else that's impacted by this scandal, and how that ties into the struggles that we have here and that you've also been working on in Appalachia as far as trying to stop the fossil fuel machine from just steamrolling over communities. Do you think that all this turmoil in Washington might actually help our case of trying to slow down the fossil fuel train here in the Northwest?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I haven't thought about it in quite that way, but it's an interesting. I mean, it'd be good, I think, for somebody, and maybe this radio program is the start of it, to begin to sort of draw out the connections between, the origin story for what's going on in D.C. right now, which is, entanglement with other governments in complicated ways. The gas industry is involved in these questions. And I think it should be by now abundantly clear that kind of allying ourselves with the fossil fuel industry, whether it's domestically or internationally, is just a recipe for disruption and for kind of bad outcomes. And so I think it'd be fun to figure out what the contours of that case are and begin to make it. But I don't exactly have it cemented well in my mind at this point. I'm curious what your thought was, Barbara.
Well, actually, I was up in Washington first in Lacey on Monday at the Department of Ecology to try to pressure them to deny the shoreline permit for the methanol refinery in Kalama. And then Tuesday at the state capitol in Washington, in Olympia, to welcome the water protectors who had walked from the Tacoma LNG tank to the state capitol, and to pressure Governor Inslee to deny create an executive order basically to stop all fracked gas projects in Washington, and specifically Tacoma LNG and Kalama Methanol. And while we were standing on the steps talking, and this is Tuesday, about 3 hours before Nancy Pelosi made her announcement, and people were talking about, isn't it interesting that Hunter Biden is on a board of this gas company in the Ukraine, and it just shows the connections that Joe Biden has to the fossil fuel industry. So it was just like one more reason not to support Joe Biden, basically, on the part of these activists who were on the steps of the Capitol. And I wonder what you think about that. I mean, do you think that this is a very strong indication of just how corrupt a whole lot of the American political system is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word corruption is a tricky one, because there is, from my perspective, there is endemic corruption related to the fossil fuel industry that affects both parties pretty strongly. Sometimes we use the word corruption to refer just to illegal activities, but that's not what I mean in this case. A lot of this stuff that I think probably does qualify as corruption, or at least very unseemly, is perfectly legal. And so, and the Hunter Biden example may be a good one in this case, because it's, from everything that we can tell right now, he isn't breaking the law, hasn't been breaking the law. It's perfectly legal to use your name and your access on the board of a big fossil fuel company like that. But to me, that looks and feels a lot like, kind of a plain language definition of corruption. And I do think it points out this, and this is a criticism of Biden, but it's a criticism of, of a lot of the Democratic Party, as well as most of the Republican Party. The fossil fuel industry is deeply entangled in our politics. It's true at the national level. It's true in Washington State. One example in Washington State, and I've written about this some, is Puget Sound Energy, which is the Western Washington utility that provides gas and electricity to a lot of customers, and is the author of the Tacoma LNG project, which was, I think you just mentioned a moment ago, a big controversial issue in the Puget Sound region. Their political spending is shockingly broad. I mean, they give and candidates accept money from them across the aisle, north, south, east, west, across the state. They are there, opening up their wallet to make sure that they've got access to all the decision makers in power. And I think it's a good local example of just how kind of pernicious and entangled the fossil fuel industry can be in our politics.
Well, another image that I have is like Monday, right after, when I arrived in Lacey, everybody was talking about Greta Thunberg's speech at the UN, which had just happened that morning. And in fact, Don Steinke had sent out an email with a link to it. So when I got back to where I was staying in Tacoma that night, first thing I did was, sit in the front hall and just like watch her speech. And the way that I love the whole "how dare you" litany that she kept going on, and just basically calling out these people like Joe Biden and like all the and like Jay Inslee, for that matter, who are not really, who are too entangled, I guess, in the fossil fuel infrastructure themselves to be able to take a real principled stand. Do you think that her message can break through that kind of political stalemate that we're in?
Boy, that's a tough question. I must be optimistic enough at some level, or I wouldn't be spending my entire life working on these issues. But boy, it's a tall order. My son, who's 10 years old, watched her speech, and his reaction was really interesting. I mean, he's, at 10, you're not sort of fully politically informed, of course, but his reaction was, wow, she was really harsh, and she's totally right. They totally deserve it. And I thought that was about right. But I do think there's this big disconnect, and I think it's going to touch on a lot of probably what we discussed today, between what we know we need to do, which is to say no to the fossil fuel industry and turn away very quickly from it, and what's possible given our current political system. Whether or not the kind of sort of moral clarity and scientific clarity that comes from Greta Thunberg and others is sufficient to overcome this kind of entrenched and, frankly, pretty broken political system. I just don't know. I mean, I sure hope so. But I don't think the answer to that is clear at all. And there's a part of me that's pessimistic, of course.
Well, actually, the sense that I had a week ago Friday at the huge climate march, and here in Portland, the estimates are like between 20 and 30,000 people or more. There's no way of knowing there's so many people there. You lost count. But there was this incredible youthful energy, which I found so inspiring. And suddenly I was thinking, this feels familiar. I thought, oh yeah, when I was young, I was marching against the Vietnam War with hundreds of thousands of people. It felt like this, only the difference being that when we were marching in the late 60s, early 70s, we were not listening or talking to people older than us. And there was a real disconnect between the youth movement and the older people, who were the ones who actually were in the positions to make change. And the young people now, I think, are so much smarter than we were 40, 50 years ago, that they are understanding that they need to reach out and they need to inspire the people in power, the older generations. And that's what I started feeling. I mean, I felt like I'm starting to see that, and it's just a little glimmer, and I know I'm probably a bigger optimist even than you are, but there's part of me that was like really despairing that morning before I went to the march, and then the march just gave me this jolt of thinking it makes a difference when there's that many young people who are really stepping up and really calling it out, and that young people have the privilege in a way of not having to be beholden to practicality. They can just say what they believe. I mean, and Greta is such a great example of that, and say these things that old people say, well, that's not going to work. It doesn't really work that way. And somehow I think listening to that burst of energy and clarity about what needs to happen, even if it's not practical, maybe is another push in the direction that we need to go. And particularly the concept, I mean, she's basically talking about dismantling capitalism, which I thought was pretty interesting and pretty powerful. And again, a throwback to what I remember my friends and I yelling about 50 years ago.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, I think you're totally right, but the other thing that I think is interesting to me is with an issue like climate change, I mean, you can make an argument that, and I think a pretty plausible argument, that, that I'm 45, and I will, and have, and we're already starting to see some of the impacts of climate change, and I will most certainly see the impacts really bite over the next, whatever, few decades of my life. But it will not bite in the way that it will for my son or for Greta or for kids these days. And so I think that they can bring to the fore this notion of, not only the sort of the clarity and the energy, but this sense of like, your generation, your older generations have totally screwed the younger generations. And we've basically left them with this enormous bill that they can't pay. And I think that there's something in that kind of outrage and that kind of that real sense of sort of injustice, that is pretty compelling, and I kind of wonder whether it's some aspect of that that's able to eventually sort of break through and say, look, we have got to try to come up with some way for them to be able to manage this bill that's headed their way, because there's no chance that climate change is not going to impact them in some fashion. The question is, is it going to be, pretty serious or pretty horrible, and I when I talk to my peers and other folks, that's kind of the sense I get is that there's something in that kind of that completely correct sense of outrage that kind of activates our guilt maybe it's just my guilt as a parent or. But I think a lot of people feel something like that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle. Right now we're talking about the impact of Trump's impending impeachment and connecting that to the struggle of young people to survive by really expressing themselves very vocally and very solidly about climate change. I think that youth movements really have a lot of power. And this is one of the things that I think in my course of my life, I've gone back and forth about this. But I remember in the late 60s, in the early 70s, well, I mean, we basically helped to get a president impeached. Well, he did an awful lot, or he would have been impeached if he hadn't resigned. That's Nixon. He did an awful lot, as Trump has done, to incriminate himself. But I think that part of the reason why he was being scrutinized and part of the things that and his reasons for being paranoid in the first place had to do with this youth movement. And I see a lot of parallels there. And I feel like there's so much power when youth really stand up. I mean, look at what's going on in Hong Kong right now, that there's something about young people don't have the same things at stake as older people do. They don't have a house and a mortgage and all this other stuff. And so maybe there's a clarity that they have as to where we need to go. So the question is, how do those of us who are entangled with the complexities of older life, how do we understand their clarion call and figure out how to support them and follow them?
Yeah, I like the way you framed that up. I mean, it does feel like the onus is sort of on those of us who have access to power in some form or another to kind of, you know, bring those voices forward and bring those perspectives forward and do what we can to weave them into our political discourse and into our political decision making. I think you're really right that youth movements, sort of as a general matter, have a particular force and resonance that isn't the same, you know, as a bunch of older folks trying to do the same thing, and they're so damn energetic. And I think everyone sort of, you know, you look at the climate march or at the Hong Kong protests, as you say, and you see this. There's this sense of belief in the world's possibility that is awfully hard to deny or to want to deny. And I think we all kind of want to nourish that on some level. Like, we all kind of, it reminds us, I think, of our sort of better moral angels, so to speak. So I guess one way to connect this up, you know, maybe with sort of local fossil fuel issues, is it does make me really happy when somebody in power changes their mind. And, you know, I think as humans, as we get older, it's harder and harder to change our minds about things. It's harder and harder to get moved off a position we've established. But it happens once in a while. And when that does happen, you know, I think it's a really positive sign that those youth movements can be effective, and they have to be assertive. They have to really push. They have to disrupt things. And also, it's encouraging to me that once in a while, us old folks can learn to listen, and change our viewpoints. And I think, you know, Jay Inslee deserves some serious criticism for having backed a couple of fracked gas projects that are now, well through the permit process or the review process in Washington. He also deserves credit for changing his mind about a couple of those, and in the course of his presidential campaign, coming around and saying, you know what, I was mistaken about that. When we need to, you know, I cannot in good conscience support the development of these projects anymore. To me, that kind of turn is what we need to see from a whole bunch of other elected officials in the Northwest and well beyond.
But actually, this is my sense from being at the state capitol last Tuesday, and Inslee wasn't there. He was speaking at the climate summit back in New York at the UN. We talked to his chief of staff, and this demonstration is being led by indigenous people. And that's another difference. It's like, and then the ultimate is the indigenous youth, and particularly the Pacific Islander. There was a whole lot of Pacific Islander young people who spoke at the Portland March, and that there's a certain kind of moral epitome that these people have, both being young and being indigenous and having this clarity that you don't have as a European descendant person who's a descendant of colonialists or whatever, that you can see how it splits, how the issue splits, and how we're the only path that makes sense is. And yet, when we were talking to Inslee's chief of staff, he's basically saying, well, the governor can't do an executive order because of this, this, and that legally, and we've got this other executive order that's still tied up in the courts, and it's not as easy as you say. And sometimes I look at them and think, listen to the kids. I mean, maybe it isn't as hard as you think it is, and maybe you have to stick your neck out on the line. And Paul Tjokten, who is he's a indigenous leader in the the Puget Sound area and the founder of Protectors of the Salish Sea and one of the leaders of this walk from the LNG tank to the Capitol. And he's made this incredible speech on the steps of the Capitol where he's basically calling out on Jay Inslee, as everybody else was who was speaking, and was to say basically, Jay Inslee, recognize that your career, your political power, that's not what's important. What you have to take a stand for is the future of our children. And that's the clincher line, I think, where maybe we can reach people.
Right, and I think we need to continue that message and to broaden it to other elected officials as well. I mean, that movement that's happening right now, that is, it feels like it's just sort of bubbling up out of the earth, is so inspiring to watch, and it's so powerful. In part because it is so assertive, like it is not sort of pulling punches and taking this kind of, you know, moderated, you know, view about, you know, we'll do these three things first, and then that will lead to some other things, and then after that we'll do, you know, it's not kind of playing that long political calculus game. It's making a clear sort of defined moral stance, and I think it's super exciting to watch. And you know, and I'd love to see that same call delivered to so many other folks in the political system right now. You know, I think that not every single person, but most of the congressional delegation for the Northwest needs to hear that. There are one or two other governors I can think of who probably need to hear that message as well. I'm glad you were able to be there. I wasn't able to be there for that event, but it's certainly striking to see, for sure.
Well, actually, I'm doing this documentary that you're aware of because you're in it, about the frack gas projects in the Northwest, the Coamo Methanol and Tacoma LNG and Jordan Cove. And it's going to be airing on Friday. And I had it was finished, like, before I went up to Washington last week. And it ended on a rather somber note, and I wasn't really happy with it. But I took my recorder up to the demonstrations, and I recorded these powerful speeches by Paul and by Dakota Case, and that became the end of the documentary. And when I put it together, it was like, okay, this documentary now ends with a fight, as opposed to like going, you know, boy, it's so hard, which is the way it ended before. So I feel that that's the difference that I saw this week. And I'm hoping that other people are also starting to realize that there is a fight in us that really can come forward.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And I mean, and I think that's sort of the magic of the thin green line. I sort of came up with that phrase as a way of describing a regional dynamic, some of which I've played a role in, and a lot of which I've had no role in, but that I think is really real and powerful. And it's this sense, and it's coming up all over the Northwest, that people are not going to accept sort of political reality as it now defines these issues around fossil fuels and extinction and indigenous rights and all of that stuff, because they're all connected to each other. And it's amazing to me to see that, you know, 10 years now after we first started seeing proposals for coal export terminals, that the movement is only getting broader and more interesting and more assertive and more able to deliver messages like this with incredible force. And so I share that view that it sounds like your documentary is going to end with now, that this isn't a situation where we should sort of say, well, God, we've been confronted with this. We've been dealt this awful hand, and there's not much we can do. We'll try our best. You know, no. I mean, what this movement has proved, I think, over the last few decades, or the last decade at least, is we don't have to accept anybody else's reality. We have to. We have an obligation. We have the power, in fact, to chart a new course. And so, you know, I'm really encouraged by exactly those movements, and they are, I think. Breaking free some of those gears in politics that have been stuck for a long time. You know, Tacoma, as you and I both know, is a really interesting and challenging place politically. And every once in a while, it feels like the gears kind of unstick and it lurches forward, usually in a better direction. And then they get stuck again, and then they're going to break free and lurch forward in another positive direction. So I think that's happening in lots of different places right now, and I'm hopeful that if those movements can continue and broaden and diversify and kind of mutate and evolve to meet new challenges, I think you know, who knows what that leads to, but I think it's got to be positive.
Well, I was talking with Naomi Klein last week, and she's talking about intersectionality, which it's one of those left wing terms that kind of bugs me, but actually it means very, very powerful thing, which is that all of our movements are coming together. And one of the things that's really noticeable in two out of the three fossil fuel struggles, frac gas struggles in the Northwest, is how they're being led by indigenous people, particularly in the Puyallups and Tacoma, and then all the Southern Oregon tribes and Northern California tribes that are fighting Jordan Cove. Not quite as much in Kalama, and for, I guess, a variety of reasons. But when we see these different perspectives coming together, and there's so much that white people can learn from indigenous people, and it makes me feel so empowered in a way to watch indigenous people really starting to take their own empowerment and to lead. How do you see that this can also really change the way that things move forward here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the leadership from indigenous communities is kind of, it's hard to overstate it because it's so important. And there have been, you know, in the last decade, there have been a couple of instances where that leadership has been really apparent, and it has sort of played on the chessboard of conventional politics. The best example of that probably is the Lummi Nation, when they made a formal treaty rights challenge to the Army Corps of Engineers in opposition to a coal terminal north of Bellingham. And that treaty rights challenge went through the political review system. The Army Corps decided in their favor and said, yes, you do have a treaty right here. We deny the terminal. That was shocking to see. It was a high-stakes gamble by the Lummi. It was a very assertive position. It was fantastic. It also, as I said, it exists on the political chessboard we have now, and we've seen a lot of that. We're seeing more and more of that. Then, in addition to that, we're seeing the stuff that doesn't kind of play on the existing chessboard, like the event you're describing in Tacoma, and like other Extinction Rebellion and some other aspects of the movement. I think some of which are only now kind of coming into being. Will kind of not sweep that chessboard aside entirely, but kind of invent whole new players and whole new stratagems and whole new ways of bringing this stuff to public consciousness. Because I do think that there is a sense in which those movements and those leaders, I mean, they can make a moral call that's beyond what sort of conventional white society can make, and they also are able to kind of point out that, you know, mitigation measures and adaptation measures, you can't sort of, if you're going to lose an entire coastal area, lose whole Pacific islands, you know, that is fundamentally it's not both build a higher seawall, or fine, we'll do better forest fire prevention, or fine, we'll do something else to manage the effects of climate change. And the indigenous communities are able to point out correctly that this stuff is existential. And ultimately, it's existential for all of us, not just for indigenous cultures. But so I think there's something kind of in that space where the movement's going to only get more and more powerful.
Well, also, just to let people know that the struggles to stop the Kalama Methanol Refinery and Tacoma LNG are continuing weekly. Every Monday morning at 8 o'clock, and I guess through a week from Monday, people are gathering outside the Department of Ecology in Lacey. And actually, I talked to Dan Sears the other day, and he and a group of people are coming up from Portland and from Vancouver. So it's a pretty long drive at 8 o'clock in the morning to do that. But they're going and meeting and greeting the employees of the Department of Ecology to continue to inform them that they have the power to stop Kalama methanol. It's in their jurisdiction. At the same time, the Puyallup and the Protectors of the Salish Sea are still on the steps of the Washington State Capitol in Olympia, and there's going to be, they're hoping, a very large gathering this Saturday, October 5th at noon, on the steps to support their struggle, because they're saying they're not going to leave until Jay Inslee calls for an executive order that acknowledges and calls for a climate emergency. What do you think of that? You think that this is a tactic that might actually work?
I love it. I love everything about it. I don't know if it will actually work, in the sense that I don't know if it will result in Ecology denying the permit or in Inslee issuing an executive order. What I'm saying is I don't know if that tactic will work on the existing political chessboard. It might, and I think it sounds as good a strategy as anything I've heard of, and I love it. But it also serves the purpose of, as I said before, this is saying, look, that we have to do new and different things. We don't necessarily the Department of Ecology may or may not actually have the tools at its disposal to properly deal with these projects. My personal opinion is that we have to stop that project. It has to be denied. It's a terrible idea. B, the Department of Ecology and the whole NEPA or CEPA review process, which is the process under which environmental impact statements happen and environmental review happens, is not adequate to the task. It is designed for a different system. It is largely designed, at least in the way that it's operated now, for a government agency to get presented a project proposal and then to write up a big, thorough description of it, do some math, share those findings with the public, and then figure out how to mitigate the impacts of the project so that they can provide it with permits and build it. And so it is, you know, the shorthand way of saying that is that the NEPA process now is designed to get projects built, not to stop them. And so what we need to do is take that process or take some other process and say, look, there are certain kinds of projects, giant frack gas projects, giant petrochemical projects, coal terminals, the rest of that stuff that's driving us off a cliff. We need a tool that just says, no, you can't do that because that's obviously a terrible idea. It shouldn't be a legal project to build in the first place. And I think that the kind of the activism and the events that you're describing are pointing us in that direction, because they're, I think at the heart of them, they're saying these projects are a terrible, immoral, awful idea, and we just shouldn't permit them, full stop.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and today we're talking with Eric DePlace, director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we've been talking about just the incredible climate actions that have been going on in the last week, and a new movement that is burgeoning, led by young people and indigenous people, that maybe can change things in a way that the rest of us haven't been able to do that. I wanted to switch gears now and talk about what you've been doing in Appalachia. You haven't gotten there yet. You're still researching from the Northwest. But what is this project that you're working on now, and how? What do you feel that we have that we've learned here in the Northwest that you can bring to these people who are dealing with something probably a lot more intense than we are here?
Yeah, great question. I think a great pivot point. I mean, we're only halfway through the show, and you've already got me ranting, Barbara. So
I expect the steam to come out of your head by the end of the hour. So.
Yeah, I've no doubt that you'll succeed. So, I am, as you know, maybe some listeners know, and maybe some others don't. So, I've been working on stopping fossil fuel projects in the Northwest for more than a decade, and that's been just a phenomenally kind of fun exercise in the strangest way. It's been really neat to see this region rise up and reject these coal, oil, and gas terminals and really start to forge a new role for itself. So on the heels of that work, I've started to do some research and analysis in a part of Appalachia, particularly the kind of West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania region, looking at shale gas development and petrochemical development, and trying to figure out if there's a way to strengthen the local advocacy movement there. A lot of those folks there actually look to the Northwest and say, wow, if we could replicate a movement like the Thin Green Line, we'd be in a lot better shape. And so I've been invited to come out and spend some time with folks trying to help figure out how to do that. And it's a big challenge, not only because the kind of politics and culture are different, and they are, but because the industry is so powerful and so pernicious there, and one example that I'll use to start off this conversation is the governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Wolf, who's a Democrat and probably about as good a Democrat as you're going to reasonably get in a state like Pennsylvania. I mean, he is as ardently pro-gas and pro-fracking and pro-petrochemicals as you can get. His administration is all in on this stuff. When they publish economic development plans for Pennsylvania, it's gas, gas, gas. They're providing, I think, $1.6 billion in state subsidies for a petrochemical project on the Ohio River in western Pennsylvania. And so that's a really challenging environment, because Republicans are pro-gas as well. And so then, when we start to look at what are the ways in which we can start to turn and begin to successfully oppose and slow and stop this stuff, how do you do that with basically both parties who are all in on gas?
So how do you do that?
Good question. I was hoping you were going to answer that for me. Well, but I think the answer, and this is a provisional answer because I'm not yet as deep into the research as I will be in even a few weeks from now, but is you have to start with the local impacts on real people in communities. I mean, you need two things. I mean, in my opinion, you actually do need a research apparatus, and you do need a clear description of the environmental and climate impacts. I think we can never leave that message alone. It's not a popular one in western Pennsylvania or in Appalachia. I don't think we can abandon it. At the same time, you have to talk, you have to kind of surface and center and find the people in local communities who are wrestling with the impacts of this stuff. And it's happening. And that, so, you know, in that region, maybe a lot of people don't realize this, that the Marcellus Shale formation, which underlies a good chunk of that region, is, I think, now the most heavily fracked, or the second most heavily fracked in North America. There are some other big fracking centers, but what's going on there is shocking. And they are, the industry is trying to scale up to basically replicate the Gulf Coast. That's what they say in their promotional literature, that they want a petrochemical center that's as big as what they have on the Gulf Coast. And so that's going to increase fracking even more. What's happening in local communities there is that you're getting a tremendous number of people who are complaining about about serious water pollution issues, serious health pollution issues, or serious air pollution issues, and increasingly some really concerning developments for public health, like cancer clusters erupting, including cancers that are affecting kids. And as you can imagine, you know, once you start as a community to think, oh my goodness, are kids getting cancer because of this industry? Well, the emotional tenor just goes to, you know, a billion. And I expect that I'll be out there in a couple of weeks, that, you know, people are hot about this, and understandably hot. And it will be really interesting to see, you know, how that kind of concern can connect with the science of public health and of climate and other things, and begin to act on a political system that is frankly pretty hostile to their interests.
Well, I'm thinking actually of this time that I've spent out in that area and also on the Gulf Coast. And one of the things that I recognize, especially because I, one of my trips to Western Virginia, which is really close, is very close to West Virginia, actually, and to the, at that time they were talking a lot about mountaintop removal mining. They hadn't gotten into fracking because this is about 10 years ago. But also more recently I was in New Orleans at a similar environmental journalist conference. And I remember having this breakfast with a bunch of journalists and radio producers actually from around the region. And the people from the New Orleans and Louisiana area and the public radio stations were talking about how they were not allowed to use the phrase climate change in their stories. And yeah, there's a certain kind of stifling of discourse and conversation there. And I can imagine in West Virginia, it's even worse, that I don't think we can imagine here. And those of us who were from more less fossil fuel developed regions around the country were just shocked when these people were talking about the way that they have to frame climate issues in their stories. Did you get a sense of that? And do you see that people are trying to break through that kind of barrier?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's something I'm wrestling with a lot right now. So before I respond to that, I think you said one thing that's really important to draw out. So in the Northwest, we have successfully fought off, you know, dozens of these fossil fuel projects, and that's been really encouraging. One big advantage we have here is we don't produce fossil fuels. We don't drill for oil. There's a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of gas extraction, but not much. You know, we don't have coal mines anymore. And so when we look at these projects coming our way, they feel like foreign invaders to us. They feel like this isn't part of us, this isn't part of our identity, it's not part of our existing economy. No thanks, we don't want it. I mean, there are some exceptions to that. Washington has some oil refineries and so forth, but for the most part, but we're not extracting any of that stuff. When you get to a region like the Gulf Coast or like Appalachia, they are extracting it, and they have been extracting that stuff for a long time, and they really do produce jobs for those people. Now, they're not sustainable jobs. They don't last forever. The health impacts are tremendous. You know, the economics are questionable. But it is embedded into the culture, into the economy, into the identity in a way that we simply don't have in the Northwest. And I think that feature alone explains a good chunk of the difference between the two regions.
I'm thinking about both in Tacoma, Kalama and Coos Bay, people talk about how these projects are going to provide very few jobs and that most of the jobs are going to go to people outside the communities. As John Flynn in Kalama said, I can't think of anybody in Kalama who would be, you know enough to work at a petrochemical refinery. You can see the real disconnect in those communities between the supposed jobs they're going to get and the jobs that they're being told by people like Northwest Innovation Works and Jordan Cove. However, it seems like in West Virginia in particular, and I'm assuming in Ohio and Pennsylvania as well, that those jobs that Donald Trump keeps promising them in the coal mines are also going away. So how do you tap into that to help people? I know that one of the big projects, particularly in West Virginia, has been to try to get some kinds of renewable industries started so people can have jobs, and they can have jobs that are much healthier for them and also much more sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's actually happening now, among some of the advocacy groups and the activists, is starting to think in really concrete terms about what does a Green New Deal for Appalachia look like? How would you reconfigure the economy there so that you can take, and not in sort of an empty rhetorical sense, but in a really practical nuts and bolts sense, what do you do with a labor force that has been built up over extraction and industrial processes, and can you use that labor force to start building out clean, renewable energy? And there actually is, I think, a compelling, plausible story to be told, that there's a lot of, A, environmental remediation to be done, and B, a lot of potential to use that existing kind of labor force to start building out a clean energy economy. And so it's a small current in the stream right now, but when I look at it, it's feels really right to me. It feels like what that needs is kind of more oxygen and more attention and some belief that this could actually happen. When Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania provides a $1.6 billion subsubsidy to a petrochemical facility, I mean, that's a silly waste of public resources. If you spent $1.6 billion on renewable energy, I mean, you'd get all kinds of cool stuff happening as a result of that. But there are these challenges around how much of that is a pitch that is straight up this is the jobs program, and how much of that is about climate change, and how much of this is about human health, and I think that's where it gets trickier. But in a sense, you can kind of set that aside, in my opinion, and sort of say, look, we need an economic development program that actually works for these regions, and that economic development program looks like building clean energy infrastructure and doing some environmental remediation.
Well, it's been interesting in watching the right reacting to the Green New Deal. In fact, I was watching this guy from Commentary Magazine on Bill Maher the other night, and he was so old school. I mean, Gina McCarthy, the former EPA director, was on with him, and she finally has pulled it out of him as he keeps trying to obfuscate. I'm concerned about climate change. We're working to deal with climate change. We have a better plan than the liberals have. And she finally pulled it out of him that he's actually a climate denier. But it was an interesting moment. But one of the things, actually, and this is something that Naomi Klein writes about in her new book, On Fire, that the right is aware that if we really go forward in trying in changing our economy to be a renewable economy, and we really get off fossil fuel, it's the end of capitalism as we know it. And so the capitalists and the free market people, particularly the libertarians, are just like, they try to rewrite the science because they realize that the science is actually recognized for what it is, then it's over for their whole worldview. So that's what we're really looking at, I think, is like this real shift in worldviews.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And it was really interesting to me to see the reaction from the right to the Green New Deal. I mean, when AOC came out with the Green New Deal, I mean, it was a damn clever piece of branding with not a lot of content behind it. Like, it's a really cool idea that had some great dimensions to it. Super well done in my opinion, but not a big substantive roadmap kind of policy document for the country. And they freaked out. And I think the reason that the right freaked out about it is because it's so compelling on the surface, and so compelling when you actually start to think about it, is that even if you kind of quibble with certain aspects of the details, but if you start to actually flesh out that vision for the future that looks like a reimagined labor force, a reimagined energy economy and all the rest of it, yeah, it completely rearranges things. And so, to me, the backlash to it was the best piece of evidence that the thing is a good idea. And so, figuring out then, I think, how you take kind of a framework like the Green New Deal, or the Green New Deal for Appalachia, or for the Gulf Coast, or for the Bakken region, or fill in the blanks, and actually start to game that out. What does the next 20 years of public policy look like in those regions? That starts to look pretty exciting to me. I would expect there to be a significant backlash to it from the relatively small number of people who benefit from the current system. But that's kind of exciting to me. I mean, we're gonna need to have that conversation. We need to have that fight, actually.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibbutz Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Eric DePlace, who's director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute. I'm curious about what a Green New Deal would look like for Appalachia, which probably in some ways would not be that much different from the Bakken, which is another very depressed area, which has more recently had this boom, this energy boom. But how can you get people who are so attached to thinking about jobs in coal mines or fracking fields to understand that there are much healthier jobs for them that are also much provide a lot more equity for their communities, that they are, that there's a whole justice component that has been missing in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to try to speak too much for other people's perspectives, because I don't know what it's like to, you know, to be from there or to come from generations of coal mining. I think that, having said that, I do think it's fair to say that people want jobs and they want dignity and they want a sense of being able to contribute in a positive way to their communities. And I think it's not that much different, really, from what you see in Tacoma or Kalama or Seattle or Portland, for that matter. And so, you know, if it feels like there are real opportunities, you know, so take an example of some of the coal industry right now, and especially, you know, the Don Blankenship-owned coal companies, Black Jewel and some others. I mean, they have gone out of business. They gave cashier's checks to their employees, and then the cashier's checks didn't cash. They're trying to zero out their pension funds, so they've gotten screwed. And so in Harlan, Kentucky right now, and I hope people are following the story on some level, the coal miners actually have blocked the tracks. They set up tents on the tracks, and they're playing cornhole on the tracks, blocking the coal trains from delivering coal from those mines until they get paid their wages. And so, you know, I think in that form of resistance movement, that's not the Thin Green Line. That's a different resistance movement. But it all kind of points in the same direction, which is that, you know, people need to have an opportunity to earn a decent wage doing something meaningful. And I think a lot of that can be going back in and restoring and some of the impacts from coal mining. That puts coal miners back to work in the near term. Not everybody, but some of them. And then we start to look at, well, what do we do? Can we take these coal-fired power plants and can we repurpose them into something else? Could it be repurposed into a power generating station that uses some other form of energy? And I think the answer to that is it looks like yes, because you've already got, you know, all the kind of apparatus there in place. And so you take coal out of the equation and start to rebuild it, and it starts to look like you're rebuilding, you know, part of that industrial economy that's underlaid that region for a couple of centuries. And then, you know, and I think you start kind of working out from there and looking in a really granular way at where can you actually get people kind of back to work doing stuff. And then at the same time, starting to put some sensible regulations in place, particularly on the gas industry, that starts to make them have to operate in a more responsible fashion. And also, by the way, drives up their costs. And I think that starts to slow down the fracking industry and slow down its political influence.
Well, I want to get back now to what we started off at the beginning of the hour, which is talking about impeachment, because one of the things that seems to be the upside of this whole impeachment issue is slowing down Trump's anti-environment agenda. And in fact, Paul Krugman wrote a very interesting editorial in the New York Times a couple of days ago, where he's talking about how impeachment would be good for the economy, be good for all of us, because doing nothing is much better than doing all the awful things that he's been trying to do. And I wonder if we can see this as an opportunity to kind of hold the Thin Green Line while we wait for the determination of whether or not Trump is going to remain president.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do think it helps kind of activate our sense of having power again. I mean, it's easy to feel powerless when the executive branch and one half of the legislative branch is in the hands of a party that is denying climate change and uninterested in transitioning the economy to clean energy. And so I think this sort of says, well, look, political power is in this country largely temporary, and so, you know, all the more reason to continue to hold this line and continue to obstruct fossil fuel development where it doesn't make sense until such a time as we can create better policies that are based on science and based on our the imperative of climate change. I think that's really right.
Well, it does seem like a lot of what we're doing right now is just trying to, well, it's what the right does to us, too. You just kind of run out the clock. And I think it's interesting to watch the process that's going on with the Department of Ecology as far as clemamethanol goes. They've written some very serious critiques, both of clemamethanol and also of the Coma LNG facility. And yet they seem to not be sure that they have the authority to deny the shoreline permit for clemamethanol. So I don't understand how that works. It seems to me that we have these government bodies that are supposed to be protecting the environment, and instead, as you said, they're just basically helping to push new projects through. What's your sense of how can we communicate with the Department of Ecology and with Jay Inslee to say, think of a new way to do your job?
Well, I like the way you just said that, actually. That seems pretty clever to me. I think we have to say something actually quite like that, which is, it is not, I mean, there are some lawyers who are going to probably get involved, and already are involved in some of these arguments about exactly where the bounds of either agency or executive authority lie. And frankly, the fossil fuel industry is going to get involved in that dispute too. But I think you know, forget about the stuff that happens in the courtroom. I think we do need to say clearly and broadly, look, you cannot permit these kinds of projects anymore. You figure out where the levers are. You figure out where the tools are. But as a general public, we can't have these anymore. And I think at the same time that we do that, we have got to go back into the legislative sessions in both Oregon and Washington and figure out how to provide specific tools that enable them to do that. One of those tools could be something like a climate, the climate test, basically, where a portion of the environmental review project looks at explicitly at the carbon implications and then rejects the provides grounds for denial for a permit or rejection of a
project.
But they
did that. They do that both with clemamethanol and with Tacoma LNG, and the final environmental impact statements for both projects came out saying this is really good for the climate, and they used very old data, like 18, 20-year-old data.
Yep.
They used data from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, you know, to come up with these ridiculously low leakage rates for methane. And the science, there was no science. And in fact, there's a part of the EIS, I think, for Tacoma LNG, where they say that if we actually were to use the current science, then this wouldn't pass muster. So it seems like we have to go beyond, you know, saying we need to do like life cycle analyses of greenhouse gas emissions. We need to find some other way to vet the scientists, quote scientists, that are doing these analyses.
Well, that's right. No, I think you're totally right. I mean, so and you're right that both of those analyses were deeply flawed. I mean, they basically not only did backbends but twisted themselves into pretzel shapes to come up with analyses that purported to show a greenhouse gas benefit from giant fracked gas projects. So that is a flaw with the existing process that we've got to rectify. Where the lead agency then, you know, goes and hires some stock consulting firm to produce an analysis that's basically supportive of the project. That whole thing does not work well at all right now. And in addition to that, I think we've got to do something else. And I don't know exactly what that is, but it, on some level, we're going to need clear legal tools that say we're not building any more fossil fuel projects.
I was thinking, they had this company, Environment and Ecology, I think, in Seattle, do the EIS for Tacoma LNG, and I forget the name of the company that did it for Kalama, but then they both used a guy who runs a company called Life Cycle Associates, I think, he did the life cycle analysis for both of those projects. I think, well, what would it be like instead of using these guys if they used Stockholm Environment Institute? Why not use somebody who's skewed on the other side, because these companies are totally skewed on the side of supporting fossil fuel projects.
Right, and those consultants don't get invited back to review more projects if they start coming up with analyses that reject the project. So it's like it's kind of a vicious circle that's going on. But you're right, Stockholm Environment Institute or some other research group like that is conducting rigorous science based on the today's empirical literature and today's science, which those are not doing. I mean, as you said, they're outdated, they're flawed. I mean, they're using not even Trump's EPA has more aggressive methane numbers than what they were using in those analyses. So they're way off the mark. So I think there's some procedural things like that that would make a ton of sense, because we've got to figure out a better way to do the math. But ultimately, I think, like you were suggesting before, we also need some way to just say, you know, we can't build these anymore. Like, this is, you know, there's no way we're going to meet our climate obligations if we continue to build this stuff out. And that's true sort of at a macro level, whether or not you're actually kind of down deep in the weeds of the EIS analysis, or whether you just say, look, if we are building fossil fuel infrastructure across the region, you're continuing to build it, you know, in aggregate, that cannot be a good thing for the climate.
Well, Eric, we will continue to talk, and I'd be interested in once you get back from Appalachia, really getting your firsthand impressions of what's going on there. So we should talk again later on in the year.
Absolutely. Barbara, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
It's always so fun.
Well, thanks a whole lot for being on. We've been talking today with Eric DePlace, who's the director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk about the government's surveillance of Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector Pipeline opponents. And we'll be talking with Lauren Regan, who's with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Hugh Masekela about how it's time for dictators to leave. Thanks for listening.
Everything must change.